Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Focus podcast where we inspire, motivate, empower, and impact. I'm your host, Singing Lisa, and thank you so much for stopping by. Of course, I do pray that you and yours are doing well as we continue to adjust and readjust through this pandemic. Well, I bring the focus on people who are doing great things in the community and beyond. And so, of course, today I am honored to have as my guest Dr. Robert Matheny. He is a graduate of the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. He completed his residency and cardiology fellowship at Tulane University. Well, he was a fellow at the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association. And I'm sure he would smile because he's been married for 37 years to Beverly Norwood Matheny. His son, Robert Aaron Matheny, has given him a great daughter-in-law, Kate, and he has a grandson, Nathaniel. And so we are excited to have you here, Doctor, but I don't want to leave out that you were formerly the president of the Greater Southeast affiliate of the American Heart Association and local chapter, former chief of medicine and chief of staff at Ochsner West Bank. Presently, you're serving as vice chief of staff at West Jefferson Medical Center, and probably the most exciting part for everybody when we get into 2021, but for you, you'll be starting as the incoming chief of staff at West Jefferson Medical Center. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Phillips.
Yes, and it's absolutely a pleasure to have you here. Of course, we have been here at the podcast having great conversations with doctors ever since we learned the word COVID-19 early in the year. And so, of course, we would love to know, because you're a witness like everybody else, what was your reaction when you found out that COVID-19 was coming our way?
Basically the same motto we have at the West Jefferson Heart Clinic of Louisiana and the facility is that we hope for the best, but we prepare for the worst. And, you know, it to me was like watching the headlines, what was happening in China, what was happening overseas, and hoping that it didn't come here, but we knew that we would be needed if it did, and it did.
Yes.
Of course, I, in looking back, thought mostly about our economy and how the parading and how Mardi Gras plays a part in so much history here in New Orleans. I've been here for 30 years, 32 years or so, and it's I've lived here longer than anywhere else. So it's home. And to know that something that we do innately or something that's such a big part of the community would actually accelerate the arrival of this virus was, in a way, very challenging. And I know it was nerve-wracking as a community, thinking about the fact that we could overwhelm our resources, overwhelm our intensive care units, that we didn't know enough about it to give good advice. Maybe in the past, if we talked about your cholesterol or your blood pressure, we'd say, oh, these are the American Heart Association guidelines. We should do this. We should do that. But to have so many people speaking almost in circles about what was the best approach and using what would be a very changing protocol was worrisome. And so again, the motto would be that we wanted to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Absolutely. I'm sure that motto has come up thousands of times since everything has gone underway. What was a typical day, like you said, talking about just the typical warnings and precautions that you would tell people, but what was your average day like before COVID-19?
Before COVID-19, we had a fairly well worked out routine where we would, within our 10 facilitators within the practice, we had 8 physicians and 2 nurse practitioners. And so we would rotate the schedule, and on any given day, we may spend a half day in clinic and a half day in the hospital. Many days we might spend the entire day in clinic based on the rotation and who was on call for the weekend. So we sort of looked forward to a schedule of maybe being in the hospital and placing pacemakers or placing stents, doing something in a surgical type setting, and then transitioning to the clinic where we did our best to talk about prevention, talk about blood pressure, cholesterol, cardiovascular disease, stroke and heart attack prevention. That was our main focus and concern. We had very good protocols worked out to do that, probably from about 7 a.m. till about 5:30 or 6 p.m, go home, start the day over. Hope it wasn't your call weekend. Hope the other partner's on. And you probably do call about once every 6 weeks or so on the weekends and nights. So we had a pretty well worked out schedule. It was pretty formal and we enjoyed doing that.
Yes, I'm sure. And so what was the conversation like as the intensity started to build when you all were learning about COVID? Because like you said, it was in China first. And so we, of course, are worlds away, it feels, and there was no concern about us locally. But then as you saw that things may have been spreading, what were some of the thoughts that started to surface?
Well, we thought about very similar things that I guess they were thinking about across the nation, especially I think it started maybe in Seattle and on that coast. The fact that they needed a very good supply of personal protective equipment, about how to isolate the virus, quarantine and tracking and all that, and who would actually do it. Because a hospital may have 1,000 physicians, and if everybody's not on the same page and approaching this in a teamwork type approach, then we could be falling over ourselves or tracking back and forth and not really using the best guidelines that science is providing at the time. So we sort of quickly worked together with the administration at West Jefferson and at LCMC to come up with a plan. And as we said earlier on the introductions, as the vice chief of staff, there's a medical executive committee of physicians and administrators within the hospital who try to figure out, through looking at the science, what's the best way to approach this. And one of the tough decisions we made was that any of the patients who come in to the hospital would be managed by the hospitalist there within the hospital under the control of the hospital itself and the administration, rather than to have various physicians throughout the community coming in and out of the hospital and managing that patient. And that sounds easy, but that was a big curtailment of freedom. You know, you have physicians on staff with the rights to admit patients, and then you're sort of curtailing that because you want a nice, concise group of about 20 physicians who are sharing the latest information, who are managing the patients, who are quarantining and isolating them on separate floors, rather than having a physician who's in private practice, who may have just rounded in the nursing homes, who then comes into the hospital, visits several different patients, maybe taking a virus from the nursing home into the hospital, and may not have the resources that the hospital has to clothe its hospitalists with personal protective equipment and the latest science and the latest information. So that was met with a bit of a challenge, because you were basically taking another doctor's patients at times and giving it right back to them, hopefully healthy and hopefully past the infectious stage of the virus itself. But that's intruding on some rights. And so we had to have daily meetings and daily advisories. Emails were going out. The census, how many patients are in-house? 60, 70? How many more beds are left in the intensive care unit?
tougher questions even, that if we were full in the intensive care units, where would we get more beds? So we quickly went to the recovery areas, expanded our volume and intensive care unit beds, used a lot of the anesthesiologists to help with the nursing care there in the post-anesthesia care unit, which is basically a recovery area. And we had the coronary care intensive care unit, the medical intensive care unit, surgical intensive care unit, PACU, all beds basically available so that we could handle the increase in patients needing ventilator assistance and ventilator care. From there, we had to decide where we were going to put patients who were convalescing or actually getting better and didn't need the ventilator, or who came in and never needed the ventilator at all. Mm-hmm. These patients were potentially patients who could spread the virus to the staff and other visitors. So we had to decide where we would do this and isolate several floors to do that. So it was a step-by-step approach that as we encountered a problem, we would try to anticipate and accommodate, but often we were doing that on the fly and learning from other institutions what they were doing and what we had to do. So it's amazing how frontline everybody was. I will give you a story about, say, the maintenance engineering guys.
Yeah.
And men and women. So you would think that they are not that as important maybe in the facility, but what we had to do was change the air conditioning system and the ducts. Mm-hmm. And they had to rent large machines that would then change the airflow from in to out and make negative pressure rooms so that a patient in there that might cough or sneeze or carry the virus, instead of going out into the hallway where the nurses are circling and going from patient to patient, it would be a negative pressure room so that the virus would be taken out, that the potentially infected air would be pulled out, and to make these large, machines available to make negative pressure, like large fans blowing outward, and then connect the duct into from the outside of the building into floors that then suck the infected viruses and air out was just a marvel. And how they did that and made negative pressure rooms in multiple places that we needed was very instrumental in taking care of the patients, especially in the beginning.
My goodness. Oh, you have said so much that brings my thoughts in so many different directions that I'm sure many listening may not have even thought that it would be, you know, take in a hospital setting. You basically think in a hospital, everything is set. Everything is there. Everything that needs to be available for a patient is available. But we know very well that an emergency and a worldwide crisis like this really has put to the test every facility that serves patients in any capacity. And so what you're saying is not even something that is thought of because it's never had to be done, that I would think, to make a room of that type. Did that change happen to a certain floor, or was it just to certain rooms?
Well, we decided that it was counterproductive, of course, to have a patient in room two right next to a patient that's not infected in room three or four, and having the patient spread out throughout the facility, eight stories high and in multiple wings. So what they did was to select a floor, and I think at that time it was the sixth floor and possibly the fifth floors, to re-engineer to have negative pressure rooms and to put all of the COVID patients that had tested positive into those rooms. And then anyone entering that hallway would have a special area where they would prep, clean their hands, put on their goggles, the mask, the gowns, and enter that area
and visit all those patients at once rather than tracking back and forth to patients who were not infected.
Sure.
And so we developed the process of entering and leaving in appropriate protective personal equipment, masks and gowns and so forth. And the nurses that worked in those areas stayed in those areas.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of cross contamination and so forth during that time. So we set several floors aside just for the COVID patients. Anytime in the regular population, a patient in for a gallbladder, a patient in for high blood pressure or other issues, nausea, vomiting, if they were tested, and most of them were, many of them were, before any procedures so that we wouldn't have cross-contamination in the intensive care unit, we actually would have their samples, and that issue of how long it took to decide if it was positive or negative. At first, it might have taken a week. And so you can imagine having a patient in the general population and not knowing, and that we use that term presumptive positive patient, person of interest, basically, and keeping them isolated where they were until they were determined to be truly positive. If you could turn that over quicker, which we learned was very important, and then move them to the floor that would keep them from contaminating the staff and others was important. So how fast we could learn about their information, whether or not they were positive or not, was big.
Yes.
And the testing improved. We learned to look for the tests that we thought were more accurate. We learned to cross that with other information like their chest x-ray, and if they had signs of what looked like pneumonia or signs that looked like they may have the virus, we would be more concerned about a negative test than a person who had all the other signs.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that some tests may not have been 100% accurate, and very few tests are, and we learned to be more suspicious of that and look at other signs and symptoms.
Yes, well, you said something as well that we've all learned as a nation to look for signs. And I think what we heard probably the most in the beginning was flu-like symptoms. And so that seems to be the case with a lot of illnesses because of the similarities. But then, like you said, breaking down what actually stood out as to be the most significant symptom. And so learning all of the elements that you did, were there certain elements that just were more repetitive that really clued you in that this is probably it when people would come in with complaints?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was usually that chest x-ray and the flu-like symptoms. Initially, we thought it was 100% because that's all we were looking for. But it's interesting that as we watched it and learned from the patients, it was not only that, but the GI symptoms, and some with diarrhea or some who lost that sense of smell and taste, and just a failure to thrive. You knew something was wrong, just couldn't really put your finger on it. Mm-hmm. And it was less concise as we went along. But usually we would still ask about those respiratory issues, desaturation. There would be people who looked fine, but if you check their blood work or put the oxygen saturation monitor on their fingers, you would know that an oxygenation of 80 is terrible. That it should be 94, 95. We went through getting apps on your phone where you could use the correct word is the flash on your phone to look at the finger and at the blood vessels there to determine if your oxygen saturation was or not. So we learned so much, and we're still learning. I think we're learning. And that one day somebody will put it all together and maybe there'll be guidelines. And as it continues to evolve, maybe we'll be able to move faster with it and contain the outbreaks.
Absolutely. Well, at the stage that we are experiencing right now, I know that it's mixed for a lot of people because of the hopefulness that things are improving, obviously because numbers have gone down and, you know, the rate at which people were dying and coming in has significantly decreased. But of course, there's still a concern around the country because we still see spikes now in numbers of people who are becoming positive, I would say. What does that mean to you in this, you know, particular area when it comes to people that are becoming positive? Because obviously the test result is positive, but there's so many other factors that you've learned about for particular patients. Does that concern you that there are spikes in different areas? Does it mean that we're reopening too soon, or is it false positive, or what's your take on that?
Well, I think we've seen this before, not the virus, but when we would study cardiovascular disease, they would talk about the stroke belt. They would talk about the heart attack belt and how the South and different regions with different customs would have different rates of heart disease in different communities. So it's not a unusual concept. So in with the virus, it seemed to come in where there was more mixing, more population, something like a hotspot would be Mardi Gras and bringing in millions of people. So it seemed to be natural to me and to others that it would follow first the population centers where there was more travel, more confined space communication, the larger cities like a New York. We were in that early population spike mainly because we had so many people coming, of course, to Mardi Gras. So the others maybe out in the rural areas would then say, oh, that's just their issue. But what we saw was that then it would disseminate and move out to the more rural areas. And you've learned how to work and control in one area, but it's spreading to another. That's normal. That's not unusual. We should have been, I think, learning as much as we could where the virus was and then modifying where it was going, modifying our treatment where it was going. And I think that we've seen that happen here with hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And what they're talking about right now is fatigue and saying that, oh man, six have come, the next one we're going to ignore.
Yeah.
Or the Katrina story of they always have us in the cone and it never happens, and then it happens. So others may be looking at the news where we're saying, wash your hands, cover your face, and you see the news and our attention spans are very, very short, and we want to go on to the next thing. That problem should have been solved. But it's not really a problem until the hurricane comes to your location, mm-hmm. and it's not really a virus issue until it comes to your community. And we shouldn't have that fatigue, but we should just try to learn, maybe not burn ourselves out, but learn a little bit more about it, read more about it, listen to the science, and then when the time comes, be prepared. Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. You should be ready when it comes to your community. So I think that was something that maybe many people said, hey, you have to treat each community based on what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so the testing would be an early clue to say, hey, the positivity rate or the number in our community is increasing. The things we've learned, we should now stress even more. We should be more active. We should put everything into place and start working harder so that our local hospitals here in, say, northern Louisiana or western Louisiana, they should not have to have learned the tough lessons again. We should have looked to the population centers here, said, let's do this, let's shut down this, let's do that, stop the traffic. High traffic areas should be cleaned, high traffic. Unfortunately, some people think again that they are immune, that they're not the ones that are going to get it, that they have some divine purpose or plan, or there's some divine purpose or plan just for them. Certainly, we do believe in that, but that we're given extra time to prepare for what is actually a natural occurrence. We should have used it for our benefit, but some used it to do other things and to look away. But I think that we've learned a lot and that we should share that. And that's what this is all about.
Yes, I love it. It is nothing but an opportunity for everyone to learn and to be better and to improve in really every area of life. And so everyone, we are speaking with Dr. Robert Matheny, incoming chief of staff in 2021 at West Jefferson Medical Center, sharing with us so many wonderful nuggets of information that have been learned since the pandemic has come our way. And so, Doctor, you know, you mentioned so many great areas that we could pay attention to, lessons learned and things that we should obviously take away a lot of knowledge for the future about how things are approached. But how was the atmosphere for your staff and all of the preparation? Did you have the PPE shortage like so many places had? And what was the camaraderie and the morale like that you had to sort of put together?
Well, early on, we did have some of the same issues that others had. We had to reuse our PPE. I think it was just, not frightening, but just to see if you walked into the intensive care unit, the coronary care unit and medical intensive care units, to see hooks where you would hang your coat, basically similar things, hooks where you would hang the gowns so mm-hmm. that you could reuse them, brown paper bags with masks so that you could reuse them, try to use them 3 or 4 days, waiting on another shipment to come in. But we never really got in a situation where we were without. I think the administrative staff, the med exec teams always thought far enough in advance that we were able to get what we needed. And the community, there were quite a few in the community that were lending their resources to try to help us with the supply chain that would get us the wipes to clean the doorknobs and the rooms and the counter spaces and so forth. The masks would come in, and we were fortunate to have that, even to the point that I believe it was the Montreal Convention Center and the military brought in, right when we're peaking at our highest numbers within the city, and especially West Jefferson and at Ochsner, to sort of decompress the hospitals. I recall the evening when I took pictures, just myself with no patients there, but in the hallway outside of the emergency department, there were beds being set just in case there was overflow and we had to have them actually outside of the emergency department. And that was worrisome, but we were prepared. And so I think we were prepared in many ways to have the supply chains open, and we never really ran out. Had the supplies and areas ready at the Montreal Convention Center just in case we had a continued surge. And it sort of topped off just in time to sort of avoid major use of those facilities. Mm. And I remember most the earlier days. Right now, I don't think I've ever had a chance or a time to recall walking in to the supply areas that we have in our clinic and at the hospital and not having an N95 mask to use. Most of the time, we've learned to be cautious with them. We will still use them 2 or 3 days anyway and keep them within a bag, especially since we're not inundated with COVID-19 patients. We usually know when we're going to an area that is possibly contaminated. We use it throughout the hospital, but we're very careful with the supply. We don't want to mismanage it. And we sort of cut down on our use, but we have never really had an opportunity to go into the supply rooms and not actually have the N95 mask. And I think that's a testament to our hospital, the protocols, the supply lines, and the teamwork that I've seen at the hospital.
Absolutely. That is wonderful to hear. I'm sure the patients appreciate that as well, because such a big concern about maintaining the health of those providing the health and those that are in the recovery stage. Now, as you we talk about COVID, we want to switch a little bit to what drew you to the field of cardiology to begin with. And then when people become cardiology patients, maybe there's a tip or some advice that you can give someone so that they are not a cardiology patient.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's vague almost to me in a way, that real transition. But when I thought about it, it was all the way back to the third grade. And one of the wonderful things that the teachers would do in our community of Crossett, Arkansas, small town, about 7,000 people, was that they would have career day at the school. So the children would actually get to have their parents come in and talk about what they did. School teachers, my father was a minister, he came and talked. That was in the third grade. And so a physician or two came in, and I remember paying a lot of attention to that. And then someone was talking about the different specialties, and somehow someone had a model, I believe, of a heart. And for some reason, I stuck with that and always dreamed about it. Now, when I was a senior and being recruited to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, they were pushing for engineers at that time. And so I started in engineering, got a call from a mother and said, oh, I thought you were going to be a physician. So we talked about it. You know, that second year I switched over to zoology, pre-med, and the rest is history, because it was a program where you could transition on into the University of Arkansas Medical Sciences in Little Rock without that engineering degree. And so I moved right on over into that institution after applying and matriculated successfully there. And I was glad that I did. And so I was able to go back to the dream I had as a child.
Yeah.
There was just a little part there where I was thinking about something else, but this is great. My sister followed me into medicine. She came through the same institution. I think my mother was working on a few family members, but it was what I always dreamed about. It was an opportunity that after I entered medical school, finished, there's a process where you match. And I had family members here in New Orleans. I came from Little Rock here to Tulane, finished the internal medicine portion, which is the first 3 years, and then was able to successfully enter into the cardiology arena, finished my fellowship there at Tulane. And I stayed on staff. I stayed on staff. One of my first ventures was into trying to train others to be cardiologists. So I stayed on staff for about 7 years at Tulane before going into the private sector around 1999, 2000. Started looking into the private sector here on the West Bank, and eventually this became my home.
I love it. And so, of course, through your years and your experience and everything that you've seen, maybe pre-COVID, what has been the most outstanding memory or moment that you can recall and celebrate?
Okay, that's a tough one. That's a tough one there, because so many good things happen, and I remember it in segments. But probably one of the better things was to move to the West Bank with the West Jefferson Heart Clinic of Louisiana. And I say that because I think a lot of the things that are happening can happen in the research setting in a university like Tulane, but a lot of the training can go at
faster speed. What was happening is that from bench to the books and the standard research was taking 7-10 years, that it would be old before you actually applied it. What was happening is with the online education, you could sit at meetings long distance, learn things, and apply them more quickly. And I think that we could learn about what was happening at the research centers at Harvard or at Stanford or at the University of Arkansas. And you could actually not be so far removed from it, even in the private setting. Because that information exchange was very important, and to be able to do things online. So now, instead of having to go sit at a meeting in Washington or Chicago with the ACC, we could have meetings like this. And this predated Zoom and predated all of the things that we're doing now, but yeah, it was the start. And then basically we got into the position for things like this. Can you imagine having a virus or a pandemic and having to wait for the years of research to transpire before you could really learn how to use that information and knowledge? And so now Zoom and GoToMeeting and all the other venues that use telemedicine are actually very helpful and helps us to respond so much more quickly.
Yes.
And now we're applied scientists where, yes, we can look at the studies and we can interpret and use that data almost at bedside. As a matter of fact, that's what I remember. One of the things we remember the most, the patient would be in the intensive care unit room and the doctor would be outside on a laptop talking to the patient, looking at their labs, using the electronic medical record to see what's being done somewhere else and what's been done at another hospital. So this, I don't think we're going back. I think we're going to be learning at warp speed, and that the CME or the continuing medical education will be through the patient, through the researchers, all united right here online.
Well, I love that you said that, because that was definitely something that I've observed, that I've asked several doctors, you know, what do you see that you've done now as a change, a necessary change, that is something you're going to keep? And I believe that, you know, the reference of the 100-year-ago pandemic is such a difference, you know, to what we're experiencing now, where we really have not been, you know, for lack of a better term, uncomfortable when it comes to being with our family, still being able to go to the store, to still somewhat live, you know, our lives as we did, even with restrictions. You know, we're not closed off from really anything, except that you're in the hospital, obviously dealing with this situation, and you're, you know, not connected to anyone. And I think that's probably one of the areas that I've learned that has been most difficult for patients. It really speaks to the uniqueness of the human being and how fearfully and wonderfully we're made, and how necessary it is for us to touch each other. And I've learned that just hearing from other patients, and maybe you can speak to that as well, just that isolation that has really been such a mental strain on people in their adjustment to all of this.
Absolutely. It's hard to quantitate, hard to put a number on it or an importance, but it is supremely important that we as social human beings, that contact, that touching and agreeing, that working in teams, that we can simulate that with the calls and Zoom and GoToMeeting and so forth, but it's hard to replicate. And it makes you more appreciative of the time that you do have, and when you do have the opportunity to do it, from the sporting events to the medical care and the dissemination of care and information. There's so much more that's done through being in touch and being in proximity to one another and working together. We're doing the best we can through these entities, but there's so much more. And once we experience that, then that's something that you can appreciate. Before, we took it for granted. Before, we took our abilities to get together, to meet, and to do for granted. But I
don't think this generation will until they forget about it. And hopefully this type of vehicle will connect the past 100 years ago to now, to 100 years in the future, that we'll never really forget it, and that we'll be prepared. We'll prepare for the worst, but hope for the best.
Yes, I love that phrase. It fits everything that you can have a conversation about, you know, in life, the past and the present. Now, or how is the camaraderie since things have slowed down at the hospital? And let me ask you about your patients. Have you heard from those that have recovered? Have they come back or stayed in touch with you? And one other part I learned is that through the telemed appointments, doctors have told me that they have learned more about their patients because they've been able to see them in their home setting, which even helps to prescribe different medicines or different helps and aids that get them healthier and includes the family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So several stories. Early on, our patients were happy, very happy to do the telemedicine program. But then I noticed that what we talked about earlier, they still, they were happy to do it mainly because they were afraid.
Yeah.
They were afraid of coming to the hospital, contacting the virus, and so forth. So they were very happy to call from home or do the Zoom programs. But because they really have that need to be in touch, they felt like they were missing something. So as soon as we had a good handle on it, they dropped the Zoom. They're back in touch. And we've been fortunate in being able to keep it under control because we haven't had that second wave. When you look at maps, I think we're one of the states where we've at least kept it at bay. We're not one of the states that's spiking right now. Mm-hmm. And given that, the patients want to come back. They want to be back in touch, but now they know that at least if they're sick, if they're coughing, if they're sneezing, if they just had a recent infection, we have another way to try to be in touch. And I think having that comfort and knowing that, that we won't be lost to them is of help. It's one of the things that keeps them from being so anxious. You know, they're worried that they might not be able to get the care that they need and reassure them with the best that we can. The other thing was that I've watched how it actually changed the patterns. People were so afraid to come in that the number of recorded heart attacks, strokes, and things like this dropped dramatically. And we felt like maybe that was not the case, that life was going on and people were just so afraid to come that they would actually risk their lives to stay home. And I think what I see that's different is we've been able to communicate to them. We send out messages via video that we're open, that we're back, that the hospital maybe had 60, 70, 80 patients in house. Now we're down to 3, 4, 5 and less than 10 frequently, and 1 or 2 days where we had zero. And that they can come back, that it's safe. And we would pass these messages via video chat or video conferencing and marketing. So we use the video to continue to see them. We use it to bring them back and to assure them that we have, if there's a second wave, we can still be in contact with them. Just many ways we were using this. And I'm hoping that that second wave never comes here again. I think we've learned our lesson. I think that our political appointees, especially, say, the mayor of New Orleans, doing a lot of things that many would say are not that popular, you know, from putting her stamp on and her plan to probably not have Mardi Gras next year to a lot of the other events that may not be popular, but I think it's been the right thing. Even in Jefferson Parish, they've done those things. And I think it's important to put life ahead of our usual traditions so that we can do them in the future. I think that if we learn about doing the right things, washing our hands, wearing the masks, testing before, putting them into certain situations in surgery and so forth, that we'll continue to have success. Early on, I lost one patient, came in, in particular that I remember, came in, had an elective procedure done, and left. And before she could get the staples removed, she passed. And we think she may have contacted the disease or contracted disease there in the hospital. But that was before we were testing everybody, before we knew it was widespread, that it could pass so easily.
Sure.
So that hasn't happened since that time. And we've done probably 50 more patients from between pacemakers, generator changes, stents, and so forth, and haven't lost a one. But we're learning. We're learning, and I think that by asking questions, sharing information, we'll continue to get better results.
Well, I tell you, I could pull out a list of questions. I love talking and learning and sharing. I did want to ask about, because we live in New Orleans and we do have such great food, and you're a New Orleanian now, is there anything you have to stay away from because it's just too good? And you're a heart doctor. So what do you tell people about balance and how to enjoy our food and still live healthy?
I think that's the main thing, the balance, or nothing in excess. Now we talk about excess and the way, you know, we eat and live. And I remember one of the first restaurants that was in the East. I think the wife and I were out there with our son, and it was We Never Close.
Oh.
We Never Close was the name, and it was an overstuffed po' boy.
Yes.
And it would be the shrimp and the oysters, and my favorite would be the combination.
Uh huh.
But over time, you learn that life is more important. You know, when we talk about the inconveniences, we've learned to wear our seatbelts, right? In the beginning, so, oh, no, it's my choice. I don't want to wear a seatbelt. But we learn maybe you save more lives this way. And early on, that's why I hear, oh, no, I can't wear the mask. It's my
choice, right,
not to wear it, my right not to wear it. But we choose life. And so when it comes to eating, same thing. Wow, I love this. I could eat all day. I could eat fried oysters all day. But if you choose life, if you choose prevention, if you want to choose a quality of life, you'll learn to reward yourself appropriately. So we've learned about the green smoothies. We know about those things that are not so appetizing, less salt, less sugar, eating in moderation, not eating till we're stuffed, eating and chewing our food and not gulping, but maybe slowing down the time in which we consume the food so that our brains will have time to understand that our stomachs are full.
Yeah.
All those little things that help. But the food here is wonderful, certainly is, but life is more important. And that's the same message with the virus and the things that inconvenience us, with driving and the things that inconvenience us. I have my favorite restaurants out there, and we just try to limit, set an example, talk to one another. We live in a wonderful neighborhood. And there are wonderful neighborhoods all through New Orleans. So We learn to walk our 30 minutes 4 or 5 days a week. We learn to not just walk, but do some resistance training. Because if you yo-yo and lose weight, you'll probably gain the fat, but lose the muscle in those downturns. So you want to work with pulling and pushing and rowing and lifting some so that you keep the muscle. Plus do the aerobic exercises and not eating late and just so many interesting things that it's a continuum of learning that we should always do. Interface, look at the sites. I think one of the most exciting things that's coming on is the technology that allows you to look at your own heart rate and check your oxygen saturations. It's not unusual for you to stick your finger, if you're diabetic, and check your own blood sugars. You don't have to go to the doctor for that.
Right.
I think soon we'll be monitoring our own blood pressures 24/7 or being able to use the monitors that
attached to the electronic records and send our blood pressures that we're checking regularly so we can see the trends. Mm-hmm. Much as we see the trends in our neighborhoods when the virus is spiking.
Yeah.
All these things we'll use for our blood pressure, our heart rate, our blood sugar, mm-hmm. all these things. And these are chronic diseases that won't go away. Mm. See, we want a disease to be treated and cured.
Yes.
We're not going to deal with a chronic disease. We want the virus to be gone.
Absolutely.
It's spiked, it's gone. We're not worried about the second wave, and that's an issue. Mm-hmm. But these chronic diseases like blood pressure problems or cholesterol problems or problems where we're not really looking into our health, we want that to change because it's a lifelong lesson. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go through trends. And if we would look at others and see our family history and what they went through and not have to relearn those lessons, if we would look at the medical literature that's available on WebMD and other good sources where we can learn about the medications that we need. If we could avoid those sayings like 5 by 50, I tell my patients that many of the pharmaceutical companies and others that were looking at getting into that field, maybe because they could make so much money, because most people are going to be on 5 different medications by the time they're 50 because they splurge and they don't exercise, they don't keep the weight down, they don't look at their blood pressure, they don't even monitor that. So now they're taking 1 or 2 medicines for the blood pressure, 1 or 2 medications for their diabetes, 1 or 2 medications for their thyroid. And pretty soon you're hooked to the system.
Yeah.
And that system needs to be analyzed and make appropriate changes. Mm-hmm. Make changes where they're needed. And especially if you look at your family history and you have a problem with stroke, amputations, then you ought to probably look at asking those family members, what were their lifestyles like? What did they love the most? And I would look and talk to my mom about what they did as children on the farm and what they did and what they liked. And I would see similarities and say, hey, I love that, but this part needs to change.
Yes.
I need to eat Bluebell ice cream every night. Because I think growing up in a family of 7 children, 1 girl, 6 boys, both parents at home, we were fortunate to have that. And I always tell my son, my parents were married 50 plus years. 54 years before dad passed. We've been married 37 years. We expect that out of them, and we should share all that information and talk to each other about it. One of the things that's in the family is heart disease. And that if he would look at what we're eating and try to eat more plant-based and so forth, that might be beneficial. And learn those lessons and share those lessons with each other and with our patients, I think that's beneficial in the long run.
Well, I love it. And you're absolutely correct, because our family history said one thing, I believe, does not mean that our life has to reflect that, especially through the choices we make and the changes that are possible. And so you mentioned the word change and changes. And so that really brings me in several directions. But as we close, I'll ask you, you know, we're into such a full year. It's been not only hurricanes for us and the pandemic for the world, but now we're into an election year. And did you have thoughts on the protests that seemed to be interesting in the sense that there was not a lot of virus cases maybe that came out of the gathering of so many people and thousands of people everywhere that did gather to protest? The concern, I think, immediately was about people becoming positive and getting this virus. But did that seem to affect what their efforts were?
You know, it's interesting because I'm humbled by learning how much we don't know for sure. I'll try to give an example. That was a mother who called me about a young man who was at one of the colleges and associated with sports and the cheerleading teams. Therefore, they got tested. That young man tested positive, but had no signs. Mm. He was in such good shape. He could run, he could jump, he could do. And as a matter of fact, I think when he went to the doctor the last time, he was on a skateboard. And, you know, that can be pretty grueling to go a couple miles for me.
And I guess I tell the story to say, but when he got there, they told him he shouldn't do that, not because he wasn't symptomatic, but because he was positive. And then when they did an MRI, so you and I or the health system is not going to pay $2,000 for an MRI that could check. But they said that he actually had a viral cardiomyopathy, which means that his function had dropped some from the normal 50, 60% down to about 45%. And that the MRI, which can tell through his technology that there's inflammation going on, that his heart was inflamed. Mm. And that if he overdid it, it might make it worse. But he had no idea. I only tell that story to say, okay, if there are crowds, unless the testing is done, you don't know the real numbers. I do think that we started checking a lot more, and it's a blessing that not as many contacted the virus. I can't understand why, other than they were outside, maybe they were spaced out enough, maybe enough of them had masks, maybe we only saw the part where it was made for TV, where people are fighting with the police or something like that, not the 95% that were peaceful, that maybe others were wearing masks and being more appropriate. I think even that they talked about the fact that that same thing I heard, that here in New Orleans, where there were lots of people gathering in the French Quarter and so forth and protesting, very few. I don't know why. And it would have to be that it wasn't a controlled environment where I could test everybody to know. Sure. We want to know. Sure. I think in medicine, we probably have guidelines for about 20% that's really been tested. The other 80% is common sense. So I would be speculating to say mm-hmm. as to why there wasn't a bigger rise. Mm-hmm. And that we have to be knowledgeable enough to know that there's a lot. That's why I say I'm humbled by the fact that there's so much that I don't know. I can't really say why. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I have colleagues and I've talked with others and said that I think that change is important. And what I've learned to do, I think, is not to change who I am. I'm not the one out there marching. My march is in the hospital, where I think there's has been in the past some difference in the care among my patients. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that all of my patients are getting the same care. Mm-hmm. So my march is to make sure that there's cultural sensitivity, that we talk to one another, that I understand the ladies I treat and not just the men, the different minorities that might be there that might not be the same as mine, and that I've talked with other doctors to make sure that through Tulane that they were learning that, you know, if an African-American tells you that they're having pain, you say, oh, that's, you know, I don't get the same response maybe as a different person.
Sure.
That we learn that there are guidelines, that we treat everybody the same, that we, if there's someone having chest pain, there's ST elevation, that we come out in 30 minutes, we don't say, is it this person or that person or this a lady or a man or black or white, we're going to treat them differently, but we have guidelines to treat everybody and that we use that judiciously. Mm-hmm. So I think of my march as making sure that things like that aren't happening. I think that just my representation by being there speaks to that, that you don't get to be chief of staff because you work in a vacuum, but others recommend that you get that position. And so that there is some awareness that there needs to be change everywhere. And that before me, a lady was chief of staff and from Korea. And so a minority in her own right. And before that, so I think West Jefferson has a community of physicians that tries to make sure that we're applying our talents and directing medical care to community without reference to minorities or the major population being treated differently. And we actually ask the tough questions and we sit and talk about those things, because I think that's where I come in. I want to make sure that the things that I was taught coming up, like there are too many liquor stores in the African-American communities, too many places peddling cigarettes. And again, in moderation, everything's okay. But I always tease them. I said, so you're only smoking, you're only consuming a little bit of poison, you know, with some cigarettes, just a little bit of poison, but it's still poison. It can hurt. And I try to make sure that we use the same compassion with all of our patients. And what I'm saying is, I don't need to march there. I do applaud them for the changes they're making in that area of change. But the changes we're making is trying to make sure that it's quality across the board, that there's guideline medicine being practiced across the board, that we as professionals have a council that's looking at each physician to make it, to make sure that any complaints are dealt with from the patients themselves. If they're valid, we want to address them. We do things like that, and that march is in my area of medicine that I'm trying to make sure that if you come to West Jefferson Hospital, you're going to be treated accordingly, appropriately, quickly, with quality standards, and that's across the board.
Well, I have to say that I appreciate your answer. I believe from the heart and from your experience is what we heard. And I really appreciate it, because I believe that is what people are looking for when they speak and fight and stand and, you know, represent what justice looks like and what equality looks like. They want to feel that they're being given every opportunity to receive that. And so I think that West Jeff is very fortunate to have you and all that have come before you and that have, you know, paved the way for you to be able to do what you're doing. And so as you move into 2021 with all of these advances and technology, hopefully not COVID, but what are you looking most forward to as you take on this new position and challenge?
I think I look forward to making a difference. I have talked again about the things I learned from the American Heart Association, not just to measure disease, but to measure health. Try to look at setting a standard for eating more vegetables, achieving goals with blood pressure guidelines. A lot of this is built into our medical records. Instead of waiting for someone to come in with disease, trying to reach out to the community, offering health fairs, communicating more, and working in the area of prevention. So rather than waiting for a problem to happen, even healthy people, get them exercising, not waiting until you have a heart attack, getting healthy people or people who think that they're healthy to set a different goal or standards and continue to work toward these goals. We don't really want to wait until we're spending millions of dollars and busting the budget, whether it's through the insurance companies or out of our pockets, to pay for $100,000 surgeries for pacemakers, defibrillators, open heart surgery, and things like that. Yeah. If we as a group could be more healthy, and if we as a hospital could lead our community in that stance, I would be happy just seeing that I made a difference in reaching out to the community and affecting that change. As a physician, I get to do it one-on-one. As the chief of staff, hopefully I can get to do it community-wide and then challenge others within our community, because there are other hospitals, Truro, now East Jefferson, Children's Hospital. As communities, we could work together to set standards in our communities, challenge the others to do that same thing, and challenge each other to do a better job within our own communities. And I think that I want to be able to leave West Jefferson and the entire community a better place during my 2-year stint as the chief of staff.
That is going to be wonderful. I can already tell because your energy and your foresight is already in place. And I think they're going to benefit in so many ways from that. Your population that you serve, is it primarily the elderly? Does it include children? Or what is the age range of that?
Usually our age range is the adult population, 18 and older. Okay. Rarely we might get a younger patient. Fortunately, we have a children's system within our medical community that will take care of the 18 and younger.
Okay.
As a cardiologist, there are pediatric cardiologists there that deal with a lot of the congenital heart disease. And because they've done an excellent job, these patients are living longer. So we have to work together with them in that transition period. But our population is 18 and older. The oldest patient that I put a pacemaker in was 88. And she was asking me, and the family was asking me about whether or not they should even do it. And I remember going to, I think, her 100th birthday party. Wow. And I think she lived to about 105. We had to replace the battery because she was still
living. Well, that's a good problem.
Family and good genetics, and that's a good problem.
Yeah.
Our population is getting older because I think of some of the successes that they personally have made in lifestyle changes and the medicines that we use. And so the problem is getting tougher when you're dealing with trying to do a procedure on a 90-plus-year-old. And that alone is new territory because many of those patients are not in the trials that we use. So much of the information we're learning is from patient to patient. The patients are teaching us and we're sharing that information.
Well, as you've said before, you are humbled because you continue to learn and there is so much to learn. And I don't know if there's been a time when the world of doctors have been studying the same thing for the same cause, to save lives and to make people healthier and better. I think that is such a gigantic project that everybody can be proud of, just to be a doctor in the world and be all studying the same thing. Are you looking forward to a vaccine?
I am. And I'm looking forward to not rushing the process, validating the outcomes, making sure that we do it the right way. I believe there are several different companies coming out with vaccines. Our history years ago from thalidomide babies in England, where they might have rushed the process and put out a product that caused issue. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for the best, like the polio vaccine coming out and changing the world. We want something like the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping that this vaccine is helpful. Certainly, there are some concerns about the fact that it's a RNA virus which can mutate. And if you make a vaccine that handles one issue, will you be dealing with a different need the next year with a new vaccine, such as the flu, strains A, B? Which strain is it? And do we have the right vaccine?
Right.
So certainly there are challenges, but the new technology, the new camaraderie and working together, hopefully from multiple countries, multiple scientists, the doctors, the nurses. We think about what? Was it Florence Nightingale, the nurse who learned about aseptic technique. And I think she was caring for either soldiers in the Civil War, I believe. And she just noticed that, you know, if she cleaned her hands and clean the area and the wound. This was the nurse, not the doctors, who learned about that aseptic technique early on. Just those things, the entire team of people, from the patients and their observations to the nurses and the respiratory therapists and the people working within the facility, we'd all work together as a team. I think there's nothing we really can't overcome, and I think we're on this earth to contribute.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I am sure that you are like most doctors I've talked to who love their nurses more than ever before.
Oh, absolutely.
They have risen to levels that they probably didn't know they could achieve. But I think that doctors have become aware that, my goodness, I have really some fantastic nurses. And so just heroes all around. And so I cannot thank you enough for your time and just for sharing your heart and all of your work and the challenges and just this journey that, you know, we continue to travel right now, because it's not over yet. But the process and the success, I think, just speaks to all of the efforts that all of you doctors are doing. And so I want to say thank you as a citizen, but also just understanding what it means to be on the front line is a dedication that can only come from the heart. So we appreciate you being a heart doctor. And maybe if everybody gets well, you can go into zoology a little bit.
Well, let me thank you as well. One of the things that happens is the stress of the front line, the stress of the patients. Sometimes you get a little worn out. I mean, that's one of the things they talk about with the physicians, that you want to just go home and relax. You don't want to hear anything. You don't want to talk. You want to do. But Dr. Akula's vision, your hard work in contacting me multiple times, communicating with me enough, and working hard to make sure that we communicate some of this. It's almost like my wife, who always says when we get together at a family reunion or something, everybody's got to take pictures. You're going to forget this.
Yes.
But sometimes we're working so hard and with our noses to the ground that we don't document, that we commemorate. And your work and your professionalism in putting this program together and getting me to this interview, I appreciate it.
Oh, well, it has been my pleasure. And that's very true. We have to take pictures. I agree with your wife. We have to document everything, because those are the memories that we can look back on to just talk about what it was that day that made it so special. So I can definitely look back on this and think about a lot and reflect on a lot. But of course, we are looking forward to next year, and maybe we can revisit again to see how things are going. And it would just be a pleasure. And again, congratulations to you. And we know that West Jeff and everybody is going to benefit well from your service.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, everyone, this has been another Focus podcast. Of course, it's been my pleasure, and I want you, as always, to stay focused.